From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, the chairman of the City of Wauwatosa's Equity and Inclusion Commission talks about how they're pushing for change. Then two Black women of trans experience discuss the many inequities facing transgender people.
Whether we know each other or not, whether we will call each other friends or not, we are really all a family, and we all have grown up with each other and been a part of and seen different parts of each other's journeys. And a lot of that includes times when Black trans women are not safe.
Plus, we learn about the Milwaukee Art Museum's plan to reopen and how the pandemic has changed their business model.
It's a two-track system. It's really what we do on site and what we do online that will always complement each other. So that's been a big lesson for us over this time period.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. It's been about a year since the City of Wauwatosa created its Equity and Inclusion Commission. The advisory group makes recommendations to the mayor, common council, and city staff. The hope is those recommendations will foster a positive environment of equity and inclusion and celebrate diversity in the City of Wauwatosa. Since the killing of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer, the commission is putting more attention on policing. They're pushing for all Wauwatosa police officers to have body cameras and eliminating no-knock warrants and chokeholds. WUWM's LaToya Dennis spoke with the chairman of the commission, Sean Lowe, about what he hopes they can accomplish for the city and its residents.
Being on the commission is extremely important to me because as an urban leaguer, I've been fighting for civil rights and racial justice the majority of my adult life. For the past 15 years, I've served in various positions with the Urban League, currently national treasurer of the National Urban League Young Professionals. So this was another avenue to make direct impact and my city and serve at a level where I have a say-so and an additional vote on how things get done and handled to advance our community, move us forward to racial equality.
So when you talk about racial equality, what does that look like to you?
To me, it looks like some of the things that we are focusing on right now and have voted on, such as bringing forth a recommendation that all the City of Wauwatosa police officers have body cameras, bringing forth a recommendation that all no-knock warrants be banned in the City of Wauwatosa, bringing forth a recommendation all chokeholds be banned by our police officers in the City of Wauwatosa. So racial equity looks like eliminating things that are unnecessary for our police officers to do. And we haven't even touched yet on housing and transportation and jobs. So there's a lot of different avenues when it comes to true racial equality and making sure that we also have equal opportunities and a seat at the table.
Now, let's talk a bit more about some of the things your committee is touching on right now. You mentioned body cameras. What's happening in Wauwatosa concerning body cameras?
They do not have enough body cameras for every officer. They have the cameras in the squad cars. They do have body cameras for the individuals on the motorcycle unit, but they don't have them for each and every officer. I want to make sure we don't just have cameras in squad cars, but we have body cameras for each and every police officer on the force. This is long overdue. This is a budget item that cannot wait. This is something that the City of Wauwatosa should have passed long ago. So what I'm doing is making sure that in this moment, during this time, in our history where there's so much focus on good community policing that the city of Wauwatosa police officers all have body cameras on them right now.
What about no-knock warrants?
I personally will not allow Breonna Taylor incident that happened in Louisville, Kentucky, that happened in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. We will never have a Breonna Taylor incident happen here. It shouldn't have happened there, and I will ensure that once we ban no-knock warrants, that we will never have an incident like that in our city, to scar our city like that, to have somebody go, if you will, to the wrong address. We can't have those types of mistakes happen where lives are being lost because somebody went to the wrong address or knocked on the wrong door.
Now, you also mentioned chokeholds. We can't even have this discussion without talking about chokeholds or other maneuvers that could cause someone not to be able to breathe properly, given how George Floyd in Minneapolis was killed, which set off all of these protests really around the world.
So a ban on chokeholds in the city of Wauwatosa is to ensure that an Eric Garner situation never happens in the city of Wauwatosa. A George Floyd incident never happens in the city of Wauwatosa. We took it a step further with the ban of chokeholds to ensure that also police officers are not using any chokeholds or moves, period, that restricts the airways and the air passages of any individuals that they detain. If you have to use a chokehold on somebody, then you're not qualified to be a police officer, period. If you have to use a chokehold on somebody, then you need to go back to basic training as a police officer. That should not be any type of policing that gets done in the city of Wauwatosa.
You know, members of the public are also calling on Wauwatosa police to collect demographic data on anyone they stop. Your commission supports this. Why?
If a police officer is going to take the time to detain someone, run their license plate, run their driver's license, ask them why they're in this part of town or this neighborhood, we want to make sure that there's just cause for that traffic stop. If we want to make sure that no minorities are being detained unlawfully, illegally, and no minorities are being detained just because they're minorities in one of the nice neighborhoods in Wauwatosa. We want to make sure that everyone feels welcome in our city, and anyone, regardless of color or sexual orientation, feels they can work out, jog, walk with their families, hike, and go anywhere they see fit in the city of Wauwatosa.
Now, you said that you're going to make sure that your voice is heard and moving things forward there in terms of equity and diversity and inclusion and the such. But how do you ensure that? I mean, this isn't to diminish the commission whatsoever, but your advisory, correct?
Well, we are advisory. However, once we make those recommendations, they get put on the agenda for the appropriate committee. So without those recommendations from us, and we have direct access, remember, the mayor, the police chief, the fire chief, and the city alderman are all part of our commission and non-voting roles. So during our meetings, I'm speaking directly to individuals who do have direct voting access and major roles in ensuring that these things can get done. So when we make official recommendations, they may go directly to the Government Affairs Committee to be on their agenda. Therefore, the City Council can then vote on items that we recommend. So even though we're an advisory role, I think that everyone from the mayor on down definitely respects hearing from some of the most diverse citizens and the most diverse citizen body of a commission that they have in the city of Wauwatosa.
Now, we've talked about a number of things that you never want to see happen in Wauwatosa and that you're working to ensure do not happen. But there have been things that have happened in recent history, right? There was the shooting death, which is still under investigation, of Alvin Cole by Officer Joseph Mensa. And before that, he shot and killed a young black man by the name of Jay Anderson, of which, you know, no charges were filed. And there was another young man before that. People are calling for this officer to be fired, and not only fired, but charged. Is that something that your commission can weigh in on?
That's a great question. So, charges of that magnitude and action that needs to take place would go to the police and fire commission. My commission will weigh in on certain parts of that, such as making sure that Mrs. Cole, Alvin Cole's mother, gets the proper apology that she deserves from the Wauwatosa Police Department. She was actually at a recent meeting of ours, so we were a bit concerned to hear from her on her timeline of events, if you will, on how she was notified and when she was notified, and making sure that she does get an apology from the city, number one, and a full investigation. So full investigation is something that, you know, we want to ensure that is done. However, luckily, it is handled by an outside party. It's turned over to the district attorney in the Milwaukee district attorney's office. So that's a little out of our hands, so to speak. But I am pleased that it goes to another investigator outside of the police department that happened to do the investigation.
You know, I was watching the meeting and I thought it was interesting because while it's out of your hands, members of your commission apologized to Alvin Cole's mother. Why?
My commission did not feel that the apology she received or lack of apology was appropriate. Therefore, that is something my commission will weigh in on. And ensuring that if the police officer kills someone, and someone's teenage son at that, that the police department should be able to issue an apology, direct apology to that person, and a phone call to that person. And it seems like what we're looking for and what we feel is a humane and right thing to do, those steps we're not done to our liking. Therefore, that's something that we do want to weigh in on and make sure that justice is done, at least in that regard.
Sean, have you ever had an experience with the police that you'd like to talk about?
So when I was a student at UWM and I was staying late to do homework, and driving home with a friend of mine, and me and him got pulled over in Shorewood because the police officer said I made a wide turn. So not only did we get pulled over, he asked me, was I drinking? And I was like, no, we were at UWM studying. And he asked me to step out the car. So we both had to step out the car, and his partner had his hand on the gun holster the whole time during this whole encounter with us. So I was extremely scared and fearful of my life. And he shined a flashlight in the back seat of my car and said, what's in the book bags? And I said, our books are in the book bags. We just left school. And he made both of us, me and my friend, take our book bags out and open our book bags to show him that it was just our books in there and we weren't selling drugs. So then he let us go and told me to make sure, you know, we drive, you know, straight home and all that. But again, the encounter was a perfect example of racial profiling. You pull two black males over in Shorewood for a Y turn. That, to me, was an encounter of racial profiling in Shorewood.
And what did that experience feel like for you?
It was humiliating. It's something that I'll never forget for the rest of my life, what that felt like. And it was very scary. I remember after that, I was really scared to even stay late at school and study, and I wanted to make sure I got home before the sun went down, because especially those streets in Shorewood, there was not a lot of traffic. So I remember it was just literally my car and the police car there. There wasn't other cars driving past. So if something would have happened, nobody would have saw what would have happened, which is even scarier to me. So it's just things that I have to be cautious of, going forward. But yeah, we continue to suffer traumatic experiences in the African-American community.
Sean Lowe is the chairman of the Equity and Inclusion Commission for the city of Wauwatosa. He spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis. Coming up next, two local black women of trans experience talk about their community. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM now. I'm Joy Powers. Black transgender people have been involved in racial and LGBTQ justice movements from their foundations. But their needs generally haven't been prioritized. Trans women of color face higher rates of violence, poverty, and homelessness when compared to the general population. Now we're finally starting to see not just more trans visibility, but elevation, especially in the Black Lives Matter movement. To get a firsthand perspective on the challenges facing Black women of trans experience, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by two local women. El Halo is a community activist and an LGBTQ health equity advocate. Naomi Antrell Jones is a prep services coordinator at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Jones starts by sharing the challenges of being trans and Black in the state of Wisconsin.
It's extremely difficult just being a person of trans experience in Wisconsin, then to throw on top of Black and the climate that we're in. What led me to this type of work was just seeing that there was no spaces for trans women. And then there were like a lot of, oh, whenever there's something big and they want someone to speak, then they invite the trans woman, but there's never no spaces where we get the same response and the same safety and the same care as anyone else in the community. There's been several times just being out in the community and sexually assaulted and, you know, things like that. And that's on a normal basis and no one cares because we're trans. And that happens on such a regular basis. And it led me to like this work because I felt like we got to talk about it because we are human. We're not just some sexual objects that should be objectified and you know, just and mocked.
As young Black trans women in Milwaukee, there are internal community politics. There are things that continue to ostracize us even within the Black queer community. And we are judged and examined just quite frankly in ways that cis people and that other queer identities don't have to deal with, even other trans people. And in many ways, our experiences with other trans people and non-binary people are the same. We are disproportionately affected by sexual harassment and assault. I like to particularly identify that we get stalked and cyber stalked on a regular basis in those things produce confusion and anxiety and paranoia, and we're solicited regardless of the existence of consensual sex work or not. We're solicited and harassed and hounded and even left to believe in our socialization just as Americans and with our current mainstream culture that sex work or fashion or drag or retail are the only ways in which trans women can find employment or can find gainful employment. And we need to decriminalize sex work for the benefit particularly of Black trans women, of trans women, and to do that in a way that centers trans women. I think in Milwaukee, I think we're in a unique place in a lot of different ways because of our size, the size of our city. I think it makes it possible for us to connect in ways that aren't possible in bigger cities. And like all the girls, like we know each other and you know what I mean? In the whole Black queer community here in Milwaukee, at like, you know what I mean? At a certain point, we've all grown up with each other, whether we know each other or not, whether we will call each other friends or not, we are really all a family and we all have grown up with each other and been a part of and seen different parts of each other's journeys. And a lot of that includes times when Black trans women are not safe, have not been safe in public, are being outed, are being harassed, are being followed. A lot of times that's people trying to fight with us or engage us in violence or sex work or drugs. And in the resocialization that happens when you transition, you know, there are no guidebooks that really tell you how it is and how it is to be a young woman and transition in your own life, but like Naomi said, transition in America in the ways that everyone sees us.
Now, Al, you mentioned some of the unique qualities of Milwaukee. Naomi, do you agree with that? And in your opinion, is Milwaukee similar, better, or worse place to live as a Black woman of trans experience compared to other cities? Or is this a reflection of the country as a whole when it comes to how it views trans people?
Just overall, Wisconsin's not the best place for people of color. It's been voted the most racist city, state for a couple years now. But as for a Black trans woman, the community, like we can literally count on one hand of who is who, when things happen, there's not enough of us. So it becomes kind of competitive of who's who, who's that, and we start to take digs at each other and things like that. So I do agree, like in bigger cities like Chicago and things like that, they don't have as many issues like we do because they're not as close together.
One thing, Elle, you touched upon is the deep history of homophobia and issues within the queer community when it comes to how it views trans people as well. And with this unique time of the BLM movement converging with Pride, and for the first time in quite some time that Black trans lives are at the forefront, are looking to be included in this movement. But the Black community has a deep history of homophobia, and the LGBTQ community is, of course, a place where racism also exists. And then you add transphobia on top of all this. So I'm curious about your thoughts and reactions of seeing the Black community finally and widely come together and acknowledge that Black trans lives matter and that you need to be included in the movement, not just as participants, but at the forefront as leaders.
I think it's important that we be centered in the Black Lives Matter movement. One, because that's the true vision of the movement. Black Lives Matter was created by three women of color and by two queer women of color. And all of our movements that have produced actual change were intergenerational, they were intersectional, and people called on different people's voices to be able to lend to the movement and to be able to activate and mobilize different communities. And we have to do that again. I don't see it as like a political woke thing, you know, it's a necessity to include us. It's a necessity to vocally acknowledge and to have representation from queer communities at this time. And I also think that just as a nation and as Black people in this nation that we're seeing that this is the time that we all have to have our voices heard. This is the time that we all have to demand justice. for everything from police brutality and incarceration to our health disparities to our safety issues. And even just in the last week, there were two trans women killed, and one of them was 17 or 18 years old, Brayla. And our life expectancy is 35 years old. That's less than the Black man, and that's less than the Black queer man, regardless of the fact that we're all facing systemic oppression and facing different things that are direct attacks on our bodies and direct attacks on our health and safety.
Yeah, Naomi, your thoughts on the two movements converging?
Honestly, I just feel like it's about time, because trans women didn't just start getting killed and slaughtered. It just got publicized. And I feel that where we are now, we have nothing to lose, so we're demanding respect. You're going to either include us or you're going to include us.
Or you're going to lose your job.
Exactly. Like, we're not, I feel like we've gotten smarter on how we have to play the game. We used to, you know, try to do uproars and things like that, but now we're going to beat you at your own game. And they had to, and I feel like we have to be included because we're part of the Black community. But the Black community should not be subjective of, oh, we don't include you because you're this. No, if you're Black, you're Black. And if we're going to take the thoughts of, we are trying to stop police brutality for Black people, we got to include all Black people. So yeah, I just feel like we are demanding the respect that we deserved for years. We're no longer hiding in the shadows. We're no longer going to be someone's secret. We're no longer, we have a new plethora of what trans women are. We are not what the media have shown us as just sex workers. Now we're career women, and we are able to get the respect that we're deserving. And we needed to be a part of this movement because we've been dying at an alarming rate that they haven't paid attention to and they haven't cared about. But trans women, last year, there was 26 trans women who died. That didn't just start, it just was never talked about.
Can I add to that, Naomi? All of our issues are like that. Black maternal morbidity in Milwaukee is like that. They knew that Wisconsin was experiencing higher rates of Black maternal morbidity 15 years ago, and they stopped collecting data in response to it so that it wouldn't reflect bad on the state. Now we have the worst in the nation. 15 years ago, that wasn't the worst in the nation. 15 years ago was the time to have been actionable on that, and they chose not to do that. We've known about youth homelessness, LGBTQ youth homelessness and suicide for 40, 50 years. We've known about Black trans women being killed in this country for 30, 40, 50 years. And I think that what we're seeing with Black trans women being killed in this country is directly related to, is a legacy that begins with other women of the era that were killed, but particularly of the way in which Marsha P. Johnson was killed and how that case remains unsolved. I think it informs why there is even no effort of justice on the behalf of Black trans women, why we're misgendered and deadnamed once we've passed on, and why people allow themselves and their privilege to assume that everything is just because of sex work or because of drugs or because of things that are myths about the lifestyles and the real lives and livelihoods of trans women. I think we have to just be more cognizant of that, and there's just more accountable to the fact that we have real light bulbs. We've not been seeing HIV statistics for 30, 40 years while Black communities are getting sicker and while white communities are getting healthier. We've not seen, even in terms of data collection and the different things that we're seeing with COVID-19, like all of these things are repeated patterns that are delved out by institutions for little people to deal with. But instead of attacking the systems, we are attacked. And we're at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of the oppression Olympics, in terms of people paying attention to our issues and caring or doing anything about them, even when they're seeing it with their own eyes, and that we're just silenced and that we're just not even really able to conceptualize sometimes healthy lifestyle and healthy relationships or what safety looks like in a healthy way.
Right. And you note the intersection of health and healthcare, and both of you are involved in healthcare. Elle, you're a health navigator. Naomi, you work with children. So can you expand a bit more on why advocacy in healthcare is so important?
For me, it goes back to just the medical mistrust. And we're at a point where we need access to doctors, and we are so far gone. Like, I have a father who is he's in his 50s and will go to the doctor at the last minute. And I realized something. That is something that we are taught, and it's been passed down. We were always taught to not go to the doctor, take care of it at home, especially like dealing with insurance. And a lot of times when we go to the doctor, the jargon that is used, the language that they're using and things like that is confusing to us. They might diagnose us with something, but not tell us really what that is and how that works. So I came into this knowing that and understanding that I wanted to teach people not just that they should go to the doctor, but how to navigate systems like healthcare, how to advocate for themselves and say, like, I don't understand what you're saying. Can you break that down for me? Or can you get somebody else to come break it down for me? And letting them know that at the end of the day, you are a customer going here. You should be satisfied and you should be taken care of. And if you feel like you're not getting the right level of care, you need to advocate for that and understand that you can advocate for that. And that's one big thing that I wanted to do within my role is just teach people, even if you don't get prep services and things like that, that you should know how to navigate and go to the doctor to be preventative and not reactive.
I appreciate this question. I personally am a writer. And so I've grown up in my Black family reading and disseminating information for adults. And even now, people look to me to be able to explain processes, to be able to explain policy, to be able to explain healthcare disparities and different things, like even down to what's in the news. And a lot of that is directly related to the ways in which institutions are based in colonialism, period, and the way that American literacy is a concept and it's not like an actual skill. You get what I'm saying? Like, the average American doesn't, you know what I mean, use language correctly, nor, I mean, effectively understand it correctly. So that's not like unique to Black people, but Black people's expectation of being able to process data and collected data that's collected through a frame of colonialism is all a part of that. And just our literacy as communities is just all a part of that. But particularly my mom is an evangelist, and she had a long, long, long journey my whole youth where I was essentially a caretaker to her of having to self-advocate before we had the language of medical mistrust and before we had the language and the identity of the issue being that Black women are believed by their doctors on a regular basis. Myself, coming into leadership roles is all rooted in me coming into my transition and into adulthood and navigating those things as a community member and then being invited into leadership. And so I think that it's important to have people that don't just understand things from an academic perspective or from a database perspective. And I think it's most important to have people that are providing services to look like the people that they're providing them to. And I think that has to be actionable and not just a concept, and that it's possible. It's possible for the Diverse and Resilient Board to be over 60% African-American. It's possible for the staff there to be over 80% African-American, because that's the population that they're serving. And, you know, countless of other models of, you know what I mean, companies that are doing that and that are making that a part of their structure. But I think my self-advocacy journey informs my work. And I think that my mom's self-advocacy journey taught me that early on and taught me, you know, that there is an attack on the Black anatomy and a Black body in terms of our healthcare system and in terms, obviously, of our safety issues as a whole community. And that we do have to form our own awareness around that, and that we do still have to get services and still have to be have to educate ourselves, regardless of it being in, inside of a system that's also harmful to us.
Mm-hmm. How do you both think that leaders can be better developed within the community, either when it comes to healthcare, local businesses, the overall equity? I mean, we are seeing people are certainly starting to be more engaged in activism with the marches worldwide, but the work needs to be continued beyond when people march, right? So how do you think people can better be elevated to that platform?
One thing I always tell people, if you are able to offer an opportunity, do it. So you can march with me right now and all that's great, but if a trans girl comes to your job and apply and she's qualified, give her the chance of getting that job. For me, my own personal journey, I held off my transition a very long time. What I seen was a very long time, just so I could finish school, just so I can get set in my career. And I felt like I would be safe in my career. I knew that transitioning is expensive. And although I support my sisters who are able, or not just able, but are in that fight that they have to do sex work, I just didn't want to see that for myself. So I made sure that I made sure I went to school. I made sure that I did these things, and I held off being who I truly was, which hurt me because I just knew what I needed for my life. And we have to make those type of sacrifices being trans people.
Thank you, Naomi. I appreciate you sharing that. Just myself. And I want to tell you, like, you know, there is no right time. There is no perfect time. And it happens. We're adults. We're young women. We're adults. You know what I mean? We're not supposed to be how we were when we were younger. We're supposed to grow. And that's what happened. And everything in people's transition all happens in the right time for them. And that is something, and the loss and the disconnection and the exclusion and just the anxiety and the amount of emotional distress that all of those things compound into is effectively years lost out of our lives in terms of where we would want to be. And it's frustrating as like, you know what I mean? Like, that's frustrating as hell, you know? Like, in terms of being involved in community leadership, like, I've always known that for myself. I've always known that I would be an educator. And for that to be put off for, you know what I mean, years at a time, like, that's hurtful. And that's something that we have to process while still doing the work.
Well, El Halo and Naomi Antral-Jones, I want to thank you both so much for your time and for your continuing work.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you.
El Halo and Naomi Antral-Jones are two local Black women of trans experience. Halo is a community activist, LGBTQ health equity advocate, and a board member of Diverse and Resilient. Antral-Jones is a PrEP services coordinator for the youth at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can hear their full conversation at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break now, then learn about the Milwaukee Art Museum's plan for reopening. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. For cultural institutions like the Milwaukee Art Museum, the COVID-19 pandemic has been especially painful. Like other groups, the museum closed its doors back in March and was forced to find alternative ways to engage with the community. Bridget Globenski, the Senior Director of Education and Programs at the museum, says this experience has been a crash course in digitizing their work, but one she thinks will ultimately make the museum stronger. Now the Milwaukee Art Museum has opened its doors once again earlier this week, but with extra precautions. Globenski, along with Josh Deppenbrock, the museum's public relations officer, joins me to talk about this experience and the future of the museum. When the pandemic first began, there were a lot of institutions, especially museums, that were scrambling to figure out how their in-person experience could be made available digitally, remotely. For the past few months, how have you been engaging with the community?
Well, I have to say, as head of education, we've talked about distant learning for years and years and years and never had the staff or the time to do it. And we got online in record time. We were able to do 360 tours of our galleries. We were able to really plumb the depths of our archives to do throwback things. We were able to do blogs. We were able to do so many different ways to connect with our community in serious ways and in very fun ways as well. I mean, one of the things that artist Reggie Baylor had done a coloring book that he allowed us to release a page at a time just to add some fun to the offerings that we made to our visitors who came to see us online.
In general, museums are so dependent on people coming in, seeing the exhibits, that really in-person experience. What was it like moving things online?
Well, it was whirlwind, I have to say that. But the other thing that we learned is at that time, especially in the beginning, people were really searching for some kind of outlet, for some kind of solace in just the chaos and the fear that was circulating. And I think that museums and cultural institutions did a great service to people to be able to offer so many resources online and so many resources for free. What we have found is that so many more people were able to access us online than they were in person even before COVID, so that we realized how much broader our reach could be. And as we begin to reopen and think about the future, it's a two-track system. It's really what we do on site and what we do online that will always complement each other. So that's been a big lesson for us over this time period.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you are planning to reopen the physical museum. What is that reopening going to look like? What are some of the precautions that you have to take?
I must say, the museum that we closed in March is not the museum we are opening this week to the public. There was a group of 25 or so staff that had been meeting since April to really get the museum ready. Everything from looking at all of our safety procedures, changing all of our air filters to hospital grade, doing deep cleans of the museum, really looking at the entire process so it can be truly touchless. We laugh and say we've been touchless since 1888 because you could never touch the art, but we're really taking that to the next level so that you can come to the museum and experience it literally without touching anything. We have asked people to remember the basics. First of all, you have to go online and register for your time ticket. The museum is free the first month, thanks to the Cry family in memory of Melinda. And that was really our opportunity to welcome back the whole community, especially our frontline workers and essential workers. So we were so grateful to the Cry family for allowing us to make that offer. But you still have to register, and in that way, we keep the numbers of people coming to the museum low, so it's never a crowded situation. We ask people to read a code of conduct that they agree to before they register for their ticket. And in that, we ask people to remember the basics, that you have to wear a mask when you come to the museum, and all staff will be masked as well. We ask people to use hand sanitizer as they enter the museum and as they leave the museum. For this first phased opening, we have a one-way track through the main level of the museum. So we ask people good-naturedly to go with the flow, to keep a social distance, to really be kind. We are all trying to figure this out together. And so far we had a soft opening and the response was quite good. So we're pleased with how that has rolled out and pleased about all the ways the museum, from the store to the coffee shop to entering the museum, has made it really a touchless experience.
I think, too, it's really showcased how fantastic our staff is and being able to change so quickly. Because when you think of museums, it's such a big ship to turn. Like, things move slowly, usually at a museum. Sometimes the curators are working on exhibitions 3, 4, 5 years in advance. And when we closed our doors on March 15, I believe that was, I think on March 17 was the shift when we started putting our content online and started that task force, you know, a few weeks later and began brainstorming and creating. None of this stuff existed before, so we had to figure out what needs to be in place to make the museum safe for our staff and our visitors. And it's all within a few months. And I think that's just a great testament to our staff of being able to adjust quickly in these, you know, changing times and be really nimble. So I think it's really, really been fantastic.
Well, and with that flexibility in mind, we have a lot of places that are reopening right now, but as you know, I'm sure, COVID-19 numbers are beginning to spike once again. If you have to close the museum again, what to you is the line? When is the point that you've figured out for yourselves where you go, okay, well, we have to close the museum down. We can't have the physical space open any longer.
We have a rapid response team and this reopening team that is always looking at what the city is recommending, what the CDC is recommending, and our decisions are really based on that. So we take our cue from the medical community and from the city in terms of how we continue our phased opening or step back from our phased opening.
If you find out that, you know, say a patron has contracted COVID-19, they were just there, or an employee now has tested positive, what's the plan to respond to that?
We do have a rapid response team. One of the great things about registering for a ticket is that we know we have people's emails and we're able to contact them. So we have asked people, part of the code of conduct is if you are sick, to notify the museum so that we can identify other patrons who may have been there at the same time, the same with staff as well. So we have a process in place for tracking, and once someone is tested and identifies as someone who has COVID-19.
Okay. If you do have to close again, which could be a possibility, is the plan to just go virtual once again?
I think like the virtual content that we're providing will always be a part of, you know, what we're offering to the community. So we've built a really robust section on our website that'll continue to be robust. If we have to, you know, if we need to fall back on that occasionally, we'll, you know, try to strengthen that and focus on that as much as possible. But I think, you know, it's going to be kind of an integrated approach in the future where we're going to have, you know, in-person people in the museum and then have things supplemented with this, you know, new content that we've been creating and things that we've learned. You know, we've learned so much about 360 tours. The other thing that we've learned so much about too is the analytics that, you know, providing this content provides us, where, you know, we can see better and get a better sense of what people are interested in, what they're not interested in, what they're looking for. Is it hands-on activities? Is it 360 tours? And it really allows us to continue to keep growing our audience. We found, you know, in those first months that we began providing the content, that a large portion of people to our website were those who hadn't visited in months or a year beforehand. So, you know, we can reach younger audiences, we can reach new audiences. And so we'll just, you know, if necessary, we'll keep, you know, growing that if it comes to that.
I think also it's important to realize that we will not be having programs at the museum probably this first year. So all of our school programs, for example, have gone online. We have a studio at home that we have for families who want to do artwork at home. Our Family Sundays are broadcast from the museum, but will be virtual as well. And programs for exhibitions when we open in phase two adult programs will also be virtual. So we are moving into a virtual and on-site experience, both being robust. But especially our programming this year will all be virtual.
All righty. Well, I'm sure people are excited at the prospect of getting to see the museum once again in person.
I have to say, it's the most exciting thing to walk into Wendover Hall. And the other thing is, during this pandemic, we finished some projects that were started last year. And one of them was refinishing the floors of the Quadracci Pavilion, Wendover Hall, which when the museum opened, when that building opened, they were sort of this watery, high gloss finish. And it's back again, and it is spectacular. So everything from the moment of walking into Wendover Hall to looking at the collection and seeing old favorites, it is really a delight to be back in that building. So I encourage everyone to come back. We've made it incredibly safe, and I think you'll be really comfortable and really surprised at some of the new works that we've brought out, some of the works from upstairs we've brought to the main floor to really think about the art in very different ways. So welcome back, everyone. Come. I think you'll be excited.
Yeah. Well, Bridget, Josh, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Bridget Globenski is the Senior Director of Education and Programs at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And Josh Deppenbrock is the museum's Public Relations Officer. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.